might not capture everything that we need to be thinking about. And one of the key questions for monetary policy is whether the increased availability of flexible work arrangements has changed the nature of that spare capacity. And it's also important for us to think about whether this increase in flexibility has changed the sensitivity of spare capacity to changes in economic conditions. I'm not doing that. Oh, okay. I didn't touch anything, I promise. And so I'm going to go through some of these things, and to summarise the discussion, I'm going to talk about how our understanding of things like underemployment and the participation rate has changed over the past couple of years, and how the analysis we've done around those developments has influenced or helped to inform monetary policy. Oh, that's the title that should have been up before. That's okay. Okay, so starting with the data and my first graph, because economists like graphs. Unfortunately, I don't have a video, so I can't compete with the previous presentation on that front. So what kinds of flexible work are common? So what this graph shows is what people who are in the labour force say about what their workforces provide for them. So most workers report that their workplace provides access to carer's leave and permanent part-time employment. Over half of these people report they have access to flexible hours, and more than half of the people in this survey, at least, report that their workplace provides paid maternity leave. And the thing that's interesting about that, that's up from about 40% in the early 2000s, or 2002 it actually is. About a third of people report that they can work from home, and that's up from about 20%. So there are some distinct trends here about what people think they have access to in their workplaces. If we take it from the perspective of businesses, we also have surveys about what businesses say they provide in terms of flexible work. So for large employers in Australia, most say that they offer some form of flexible working hours and that flexible work arrangements have become a lot more prevalent over time. More than two-thirds of businesses, or large businesses, offer the ability to purchase additional leave and take leave without pay. And a similar share say that they offer parental leave. It's also been quite common for large businesses to offer some sort of flexible hours and the option to work from home. So the story that we get from the people who are working in these businesses and what the businesses are saying is pretty consistent. But I think it is worth noting that the story from large businesses is a little bit different to the sort of flexibility you have available if you come from a smaller business. Right. So a longer run perspective on this question of flexibility can be obtained by looking at how the share of part-time work has changed in the economy over time. So part-time workers are officially defined as people who are working less than 35 hours a week. And you can see from this graph that they're an increasingly important share of total employment over the last 50 years or so. So they've gone from being about 1 in 10 of the work of the employed people to about a third. So a striking feature of these trends is also that part-time work has also been a much more prevalent feature of the female labour market than it has been for the male labour market. This is still apparent when we look at things by age cohort. But when we look at things in this perspective, you can see that there's quite a difference in the experience of males and females, and that really changes around the age of 30 years. So women really ramp up their use of part-time work when they progress through the child-rearing years, but men, at this point in time at least, they just don't. The other thing that this graph emphasises is that part-time work's much more common for younger workers and for those nearing retirement age. So which of these groups has contributed most to the fact that part-time work's more than three times more common today than it was 50 years ago? The biggest contribution to the increase in part-time work has actually come from the fact that the share of young people in part-time jobs, both male and female, has increased significantly. So in 1966, about one in 15 younger workers had and was employed part-time, and today more than half are employed part-time. The increase in the share of part-time work for older men, so that's men aged 25 and older, has also made a significant contribution to the increase in part-time employment in the economy as a whole. And that's been particularly true for the 25 to 54 age group. But as you can see from this graph, the story for women aged over 24 years is actually a little bit different. So they've also made a significant contribution to the overall increase in part-time work in the economy, even though the share of part-time work for this cohort in particular has remained remarkably stable. So the way to reconcile these two factors is that the participation rate of women older than 25 has basically doubled from around 30% in 1966 to around 60% now. And so although a lot of women have benefited from access to part-time employment, there's been a roughly equal percentage increase in the number of women working in full-time jobs. And so what this really highlights is, as with many things in the labour market, there's a lot of things at work. And there's other factors such as increased access to tertiary education that have also had pretty significant effects on female participation decisions. So the next question that naturally flows from these graphs is, why do people work part-time? So the main source of information that we have on this is the Household Income and Labour Dynamics Australia survey, which we know as the HILDA survey. So this is one of the main sources that we have for understanding the behaviour of households. And in terms of the data work that you do as a policy economist, it's been quite an innovation in what we've been able to do in terms of marrying the microeconomic decisions of individuals with the macroeconomic outcomes that we ultimately need to think about. So what this survey shows is that around 20% of women and 30% of men indicate that they're working part-time, either because they couldn't find a full-time job or because the job requires them to work part-time. And the other interesting point to note about these two categories is that the share of people reporting that they need to work part-time because the job requires it has actually increased quite significantly over time, particularly for men. So these are both reasons that you could describe as being not a choice. But that does leave about three quarters of part-time workers reporting that they're working part-time basically because they're choosing to, or it's helping them to combine work with other aspects of their life and other commitments that they have, like studying or caring responsibilities. So interestingly, the group that works part-time by preference or reports that they're doing it because that's their choice to do so, it's actually the older workers. So people nearing retirement are much more likely to report that it's part-time because of their personal preference. The majority of younger workers, so that's the 15 to sort of 24-year-old category, unsurprisingly report that they're working part-time, mainly because it allows them to combine study with work. So the increase in the share of youth working part-time has occurred at the same time as we've seen a very significant increase in the number of young people participating in full-time education. So in a room full of teachers, I hope this is not a particularly surprising set of statistics. But at the moment, just over three quarters of 15 to 19-year-olds and around one-third of 20 to 24-year-olds are enrolled in full-time study. But if you go back to the mid-1980s, those numbers were about a half and 10%. So there's been a very significant increase in full-time participation, full-time education. And this very high incidence of full-time students working part-time means that Australia actually has the fourth highest labour force participation of youth in the OECD, or across OECD countries. So we've talked about young people, we've talked about older people. It may not come as a great surprise that for people in the category of the 25 to 54-year-olds, and women in particular, it's very common for people to be working part-time as a way of maintaining a connection to the workforce during a period where they also have primary responsibility, either for dependent children or possibly elderly relatives. And these caring responsibilities are among the most common reasons that households overall say that they require flexibility in their work arrangements. So the relationship between childcare responsibilities and part-time work is actually pretty complex, and it's really doesn't serve anyone's purposes to oversimplify it. For some people, it's quite likely to be a choice to work part-time so you can spend more time with your kids. But it's also quite possible that there are other parents who would like to work more hours, but access to affordable childcare is preventing them from doing so. These data come from another ABS survey that asks what sort of flexible work arrangements are being used by families with dependent children. So this shows that about a third of these families have at least one parent working part-time. Around two-fifths of these households rely on flexible working hours in some way. And families with children are increasingly using all forms of flexible work arrangements to manage this need to work and care for their kids. So the summary of all this is that it seems like a lot of people would like to work part-time or flexibly in some way, and the opportunities to do so have increased over time. So some industries have embraced flexible work arrangements more than others. So this is a breakdown of ABS industries and the share of part-time workers in each of those industries. So you can see here that businesses that are in the household services sector, which are the red bars, such as those in health, education, tourism and hospitality, have relatively high shares of part-time workers. And this category of work has actually been one of the categories that's grown most in the last couple of years. We also have conversations with firms across the country as a part of our business liaison program. So we actually go out and ask them questions about what they're doing with wages, employment, investment and the like. And we're increasingly hearing that businesses are using part-time work and casual employment to increase the flexibility of their business models. So we're hearing that both households and firms have sought to increase flexibility. And it does beg the question of whether this flexibility has been primarily demand or supply driven. At the end of the day, with economics, you can hedge your bets a little bit. It's probably a bit of both. Another really important question, which is slightly different to the one I just posed and is a little bit outside the scope of what I'm talking about today, is whether the increase in flexibility has benefited households and firms equally. So we can see from this graph that the hours worked, or average hours worked, by part-time and full-time employees has changed quite significantly over time. So if we go back to the late 1980s, the average part-time worker worked about 14 and a half hours per week. And more recently, that figure's increased to about 17 hours per week. Interestingly, we can see that the opposite trend is true for full-time workers. So full-time workers are people who are classified as working 35 hours a week or more. And their average hours have declined from around 41 hours a week in the early 2000s to around 39 hours today. And when we take both these groups together, average hours worked in the economy have actually fallen. So one way to approach the question of whether these changes have been beneficial to employees is to look at whether the people report are more likely to report they're working their preferred hours now than they were in the past. But before getting into a little bit more detail on that question, I'm just going to make a quick detour to look at some of the information that we have on how other conditions of employment have changed over time. So we have plenty of anecdotes about how employment conditions have changed with things like the arrival of the gig economy and other forms of flexible work. But I have to say it's remarkably hard to find evidence of how these changes are affecting people in the aggregate data. So, for example, casual employees are people who don't get sick pay and they don't get holiday pay. So you would describe their conditions as perhaps a little bit more tenuous than a permanent part-time role. And they make up a sizable share of the workforce. So today, casual work, about 20% of people are employed in casual work. But the thing that's interesting is that share hasn't really changed since the 1990s. So at the same time as we've seen this expansion in part-time employment, we haven't actually seen an accompanying rise in the rate of casualisation. Another possible manifestation of more flexible but less secure work is that people who might otherwise have been employed are now operating as independent contractors. However, again, when we go to the data, so you can look at sources from the ABS, you can look at sources or questions in HILDA, it actually suggests that the share of the workforce that can be classified as independent contractors has actually fallen over the past decade or so. But rather than conclude that there's nothing happening along these dimensions, I think really the message that we want to take away is that we don't really have the data that we need, and a lot more work needs to be done to investigate these developments. Anyway, returning to safer ground where we do have data, and returning to the question of whether people are reporting that they're more likely to be working the hours they would like to work than they were in the past, one place to look is the ABS measure of underemployment. So this mainly captures part-time people who would prefer to work more hours and they're available to do so. And so what we can see from this graph is that there has been a trend increase in the share of people working part-time who report that they're underemployed. And that also, by definition, means that the share of the broader labour force who report that they're underemployed has increased in a trend sense since the 1970s. The other thing to note from this graph is that underemployment has a very strong cyclical dimension. And I'm going to return to that when I get onto the implications of all this for monetary policy. So at the same time as underemployment has risen, HILDA shows us that there's been a decline in the share of employed people who report that they're working more hours than they want to. So this is the group classified as overemployed. And that's even taking into account the impact working fewer hours would have on their income. So this downward trend is pretty consistent with the trend decline we saw in average full-time hours worked since the turn of the century. Unsurprisingly, overemployment is most common amongst those who work relatively long hours, including the substantial share of the workforce who report they work more than 50 hours a week. As an aside, the ABS published some data on the prevalence of overemployment in different occupations, and the current audience may be interested to hear that in 2007, when these data are available, over one-third of teachers reported that they were overemployed. So I will leave that assessment to you. So you're not alone, I would suggest, but this is all about the question of is flexibility benefiting people? But I think overall the overemployed are reporting they would like to reduce their working hours so that they could spend more time with their families. So the HILDA data allow us to compare people's actual hours worked with their preferred hours in aggregate. And so if we go back a decade, the average employed person in Australia would have preferred to work 2 hours less than what they usually did. And that's basically because there are a lot more people reporting they were overemployed than the number who were reporting they were underemployed. But by the time we get to 2016, the mismatch between usual and preferred hours had shrunk to about 1 hour on average. So overall, this is evidence that on balance, quite a bit of the change in the working arrangements and the increase in flexibility has suited employees. From a monetary policy perspective, these trends are very, very interesting, but ultimately what matters is whether they have any implications for how we think the labour market adjusts when there are changes in the economic cycle and how we forecast wage growth. So in the textbook labour market, the unemployment rate pretty much is a summary statistic for spare capacity in the economy. As demand for labour increases, unemployed people find jobs, they can pretty much choose the hours they want, which is all based on what productivity they have when they match a job and what's the outside option that they have, the value of the outside option they have when they're not in the formal working force, labour force. But in practice, especially given this increase in the flexibility of the labour market, things are a little bit more complex. So if a firm experiences a period of stronger labour demand, that can be met in a number of different ways. You can obviously still employ someone who's currently unemployed and looking for work. You can increase the hours of the people who you currently have working for you. And you can also employ people who are currently outside the labour force. So this is this group of marginally attached workers who say that they're interested in working, but they're not actually out there actively looking. So the complexity here means that when you're thinking about monetary policy, you need to take a broader perspective than just looking at the unemployment rate and assessing how much spare capacity there is in the labour market. And in particular, how likely it is that spare capacity is going to change with economic conditions. So the unemployment rate does continue to be a pretty integral part of the monetary policy discussion. But we have had a fairly active conversation about whether the unemployment rate is really sufficient for us to understand what's happening with spare capacity, especially in the context of the question that we've been asking ourselves over, I say recently, but it's actually been over a number of years, which is why has wage growth been so low? And another consideration for our forecasts and our assessment of the uncertainty around those forecasts is whether the participation rate has become more responsive to changes in the economic conditions over time. So what I'm going to do next is talk about the cyclical adjustment of underemployment and then the cyclical adjustment of the participation rate, particularly in the context of the sort of work that we've been doing at the Reserve Bank recently to enable us to provide better advice to the board about what should be happening or what could happen with monetary policy. So starting with underemployment, a couple of graphs ago, I made the comment that there's a pretty strong cyclical element to the number of part-time workers who report that they're underemployed. So the share of underemployed people tends to increase when we have weak labour demand and the unemployment rate is increasing. And this is related to the way employment adjusts to changes in economic conditions. So this graph shows part-time employment growth and full-time employment growth since the early 2000s. And over this time, if you're in a period of relatively robust growth, such as what we saw in the mid-2000s, full-time and part-time growth tend to grow at a similar-ish rate. But when we experience a downturn to growth that leads to an increase in the unemployment rate, which is characterised by the grey bars in this graph, what we see is that full-time employment growth falls, but part-time employment growth actually increases. So some analysis that's been done by my colleagues at the Reserve Bank has shown that since the late 1990s in Australia, the cyclical adjustment in the labour market has occurred much more through the number of hours people work rather than whether or not they have a job. And one consequence of this is that when we've experienced economic downturns in the 2000s, the unemployment rate's actually risen by less than what we would have expected based on historical experience. So that's sort of pre-2000s historical experience. I just have to adjust. I'm old enough that that's actually in my lifetime, but for some people, it's post. Right, where was I? So I think that the takeaway message is that the fact that the labour market can adjust this way through heads rather than the number of people who are employed is actually a positive consequence of labour market flexibility. There's also quite a lot of evidence that the dynamic response of the labour market to changes in macroeconomic conditions have changed over the past decade, so over a much shorter time period. In particular, since 2009, the average growth in part-time employment has actually been higher than the growth in full-time employment, despite the fact that there's been a gradual decline in the unemployment rate. So this has been associated with a decline in the probability of making a transition from a part-time job to a full-time job for people who want to make that transition. So on average, people who are working part-time who would like more hours, if you go back to 2009, had a 50% chance of making that sort of a transition. But if we move to closer to the current date, that probability has fallen to something more like 40%. And the biggest change when we move to the right-hand panel is that it seems to be that people who are working part-time are much less likely to make a successful transition to full-time work by changing employer than they were in the past. And one of the things that's really interesting about this is that in 2009, the probability of making a transition from unemployment to employment also fell, which is what you would expect in a period where the unemployment rate goes up. But it subsequently turned around. So something different's happening here. So one of the consequences of this change in the probability of successfully making a transition to a part-time job to a full-time job for people who'd like to work more hours is that the average duration of underemployment in the economy has increased. So the average duration of underemployment, so the length of time you spend in a part-time job wanting to get more hours or a full-time job, has gone up from about 1 year to 1.5 years. So it suggests there's an increasing number of people in the economy working part-time who are caught in a position of not having as much work as they would like for much longer periods of time. And by comparison, you would also expect in this situation that the average duration of unemployment would increase, which it has, but it's done so to a much lesser extent. As an aside to this sort of the big picture, I think it's really important to recognise that unemployment and underemployment affect some groups disproportionately. And both unemployment and underemployment are particularly prevalent in the youth labour market. So again, this is the 15 to 24-year-olds. So about 18% of the youth labour market are underemployed and about 12% of the youth labour market are unemployed. And these rates, as you would know, are well above the aggregates. So in many cases, these young people who are looking for more hours or looking for a full-time job are also studying. But when we get to the 20 to 24-year-old age category, the share of these people working part-time but not in study has actually been increasing. And this is consistent with the fact that the transition from tertiary education to full-time work appears to have slowed over the past decade. So this analysis all adds up to saying that something's changed about the dynamics of the labour market over the past decade or so. And one of the things that's difficult for us, it's very hard to tell whether this is a feature of the current cycle or whether this is a permanent structural change. From a monetary policy perspective, the really important immediate question is whether these changes have any implications for how we measure and assess spare capacity, and whether there's been any change in the relationship between spare capacity and wage growth. To answer this question, it's really important to recognise that underemployed people do represent spare capacity, but they actually typically want fewer additional hours than an unemployed person. So most unemployed people are looking for a full-time job. Most underemployed people are looking for a couple of days' worth of extra work. And the way to work around this is to move from heads-based measures, so just counting the number of people, to move to hours-based measures. And effectively what hours-based measures is, we just weight individuals by the number of additional hours they might be able to add to the labour supply. So we can see that the effects of the economic cycle are apparent in both the hours-based unemployment rate and the hours-based underemployment rate. But in the last couple of years, I think we would say that the hours-based unemployment rate has declined, but the hours-based underemployment rate has actually remained quite elevated. Adding measures of underemployment to wage equations, going back to the question of why is wage growth been so low, does do something to help explain that question, but it only explains things at the margin. And again, it's really hard to tell whether this is episode-specific or whether this is a permanent structural change that we should factor into our models going forward. More generally, although working some hours is clearly working better than working no hours, long periods of underemployment can still have long-term effects on individuals' labour market outcomes, similar to the better understood effects of long-term unemployment have. So this is the process of usually described as hysteresis. So as a result, if we have a large cyclical increase in underemployment, it could matter not only for our assessment of spare capacity in the labour market today, but it could also have implications for our assessment of spare capacity in the future. So turning from underemployment to the participation rate. The participation rate is another really important margin of adjustment in the labour market. When labour markets are strong, people join the labour force because their employment prospects are improved. Strong labour market conditions also encourage people who already have work not to leave the labour force or perhaps to delay their retirement, and we've seen this quite recently. Economists usually refer to this adjustment as the encouraged worker effect. We saw this type of adjustment particularly in 2017. So that was a really interesting year. We saw employment growth of 3.5%, which is well in excess of working age population growth, which was around 1.6%. At the same time, this was accompanied by a 1 percentage point increase in the participation rate. And that's one of the largest changes in the participation rate we've seen in the history of the series. So as you might expect, this is the cyclical adjustment of the participation rate is another important topic for us. So colleagues of mine have looked at the question of how the participation rate of different groups in the, or how sensitive the participation rate of different groups in the economy has been to increases in labour demand. So what this graph shows is the change or the estimated change in the participation rate of different groups following a 1% increase in labour demand. The results show that the groups who are most likely to increase their participation, perhaps unsurprisingly, are younger workers, 25 to 54-year-old females, and males in the older age groups. So this is really not surprising given everything else that I've been saying about the way the labour market adjusts and how different groups of people in the labour market adjust. Another interesting example here is that in the context of the youth labour market, is we know that the young people have an outside option, so they can choose to defer their study or reduce their study load if there's a period of strong labour demand and they can benefit from that. And we saw this adjustment occur particularly clearly during the mining investment boom. So what we saw then was that education attendance rates dropped quite significantly in Western Australia and Queensland that were most affected by the mining boom, relative to the rest of the country. And the estimated sensitivity of these participation rates of these different groups is also consistent with the evidence that we have from HILDA, which basically shows that about half the people who flow from outside the labour force into employment were either studying or involved in childcare immediately before entering the labour force. So from the perspective of the monetary policy maker, any increase in the sensitivity of labour force participation could have implications for how we think about spare capacity and forecast wages growth. If it's become easier for people to work across that margin or flow between the in and out of the labour force, marginally attached workers may represent a more important source of spare capacity than they have in the past, and it may be that they can place more downward pressure on wage growth than they have in the past. So we've looked at this question about whether these estimated sensitivities have changed over time. And there is a little bit of evidence that the sensitivity of the participation decisions of younger workers and women aged between 25 and 54 have increased. But it's not very convincing evidence, so it's certainly not something that I would base or reassess my forecast on the basis of. And I think the other problem is that this tentative evidence is consistent with a whole range of things. So it might be that if the change is real, it's related to the increase in the flexibility of the labour force, but there are other possible explanations. So I think this again falls into the area of where we really need to do a lot more work before we can say something more concrete. More generally, the issue of measuring the size of potential labour market entrants is very, very difficult. So this graph shows an estimate of the share of the labour force who are classified as marginally attached. So these are people who are outside the labour force. They say they could work, they're available for work, but they're not actively looking. And what this shows is that this is a large group of people, and it's been a large group of people for a long time. And the most recent data suggests there's 1.2 million people who are classified as marginally attached according to this definition. And that compares to around 750,000 people who are classified as unemployed because they're actively looking. But I think that this, another point to make from this graph is that marginal attachment rates have actually been pretty stable, and if anything, they've fallen over time. And the fact that we don't see any cyclicality in these rates, even though we know that there's cyclicality in the participation rate, suggests that these measures are not really fully capturing the potential labour supply that sits outside the formal labour force. When we go to the HILDA data set, we can say that people who are classified as marginally attached are more likely to make the transition from outside the labour force to employment, but they still only account for about half of that flow. So if we only focus on people who are formally measured as marginally attached, we're actually missing a fairly significant share of potential labour supply that sits outside the labour force. Another factor that I haven't really mentioned and has been discussed by various bank speakers over time is net overseas migration. So this is another potential source of additional labour supply that it's really hard to get a handle on when we're thinking about what's the size of spare capacity in the economy. So this all points to the fact that the labour market is a lot more complex than the textbook suggests, and possibly a little bit more complex than our unemployment rate explainer suggests. But we've made considerable progress into understanding these things, or how to measure spare capacity in particular, and how sensitive spare capacity is to changes in the business cycle. But I think there is quite a lot more work to do, particularly when it comes to being able to forecast wage growth successfully. And wage growth is particularly important because that's a key input into our inflation forecasts. And ultimately, it's wage growth that summarises how much spare capacity there is in the labour market in the context of monetary policy decision making. So, when I was asked to speak, I think everyone was very interested in hearing what does this all mean for the future. So I will try to address that. Adam may have some views as well. So I think we can say that technological change is going to continue to create opportunities for people to increase the flexibility in the way that they work. History suggests that this increase in flexibility, on average, has allowed a lot of people to combine work with other aspects of their life, like study commitments, like caring commitments, in ways that move them closer to their preferences. So it's been a good thing. And it's also meant that the labour force adjusts in a way that's less disruptive than perhaps it did in the past. So that means, you know, maybe people in downturns are having to work fewer hours, but they're not losing their jobs in the same way. Having said all that, we still know that there are people who are not working their preferred hours, and there's a lot we don't know about how more access to flexibility is going to affect the options people have about the way they work. From the perspective of monetary policy, the unemployment rate is still pretty much the main indicator of spare capacity that we use to understand what sort of wage pressures might be building in the economy. But we do need to stay on top of how things are changing. So we do have some evidence that there is a bit of a change in the dynamics that suggests we should pay more attention to underemployment, for example. The fact that we're making decisions with a degree of uncertainty, so I don't want to shy away from the fact that we don't know everything, and that the economy keeps changing, so this question about is this just a slightly different cycle or is this a structural change, really does make the job of being a monetary policy maker or even an economic policy maker quite challenging. But when I'm asked by students about why I love my job and why I'm still doing the same job that I did when I left university, effectively, which is very un-millennial. What I tell them is that it's actually the challenge that makes a career in economic policy making interesting and satisfying. So this goes back to some of the stuff about entrepreneurship. It's about the challenge. It's about the fact that things are changing. Economics as a discipline does give you a whole range of skills that do allow you to form questions, that do allow you to answer those questions. Again, I keep referring to Adam because I saw his presentation just before, but a lot of what he was talking about in terms of entrepreneurship and what that means, I actually found resonated with me and the economics training that I've received and developed by working at the bank. So I'm going to finish up there. I'm very happy to answer any questions about the presentation. I'm very happy to answer any questions about economics, working as an economics policymaker. I'd also like to bring to everyone's attention, in case people haven't noticed, the Reserve Bank booth, the presentation area, that we do have a lot of information available that you can use to help you teach some of these subjects. And we also have now a Facebook page where a lot of this information is available. So I'll leave it there and answer any questions if people have them.
Time for a couple.
Or are we getting too close to lunch? Oh, well, even if you hold it up, I won't be able to see it. So,
okay. All right. Thanks very much for that presentation. It was fascinating to hear about the impact of flexibility. I just wanted to ask you that I always get asked this by students, and I really haven't got a good answer. When we give a definition of employment, it's working 1 hour per week. And to me, that seems crazy, 1 hour per week. And so, therefore, you're unemployed if you don't work 1 hour per week. Is there ever any is that ever going to change? Or, and why is it that that's the definition? It just does seems very... If you're just working 1 hour per week, are you really employed? I mean, if you're getting $10 a week, can you survive on that?
Yeah, so I think at some level, these are definitions that are internationally agreed. And I think it's fair to say they were internationally agreed a long time ago. Basically, I mean, I think the point is that there are actually very few people who work as few hours as one a week. So, you know, it's basically saying you're employed if you're working and you're unemployed if you're not working at all and you're looking for hours. And I think one of the things about the increasing flexibility of the labour market that came home to me when I was thinking about this is even the distinction between what is part-time work and what is full-time work is a little bit artificial. So, you know, 35 hours a week is clearly related to the idea that people work 7 hours a day, which is, you know, kind of your 9-to-5 type of, well, it's not quite the 9-to-5 job, but so I think there are definitely, so these are definitions that we've worked with for a very long time, so they're quite useful for explaining things. But I think really when we think about labour demand, the question is, you know, what's the aggregate number of hours? What's the total number of hours worked? And, you know, maybe we shouldn't really be hung up on whether someone's working 34 hours or 36 hours even. So I think it is more useful to think about it as a bit of a continuum. And in terms of is it fair to describe someone who's only working 1 hour a week as employed, I think I would rest on the fact that there's an extraordinarily small number of people who would work as few as 1 hour. So the average number of... Oh, well, I've shown the graph of average number of hours worked by part-time workers. It's sort of 17 hours, so it's between 2 and 3 days' worth of work.
Another question?
Thanks, Alex. It's always wonderful to hear you. Timmy Grinham here. I was wondering, I heard Sally McManus on the radio this morning. I'm not sure, did you listen to ABC Radio this morning?
I didn't, but I can imagine.
You can imagine what she was saying. She was talking about wage rises, of course, and so she's putting forward the solution, as a unionist, of course, that... we should be moving away from enterprise bargaining and moving to sector-based bargaining in recognition of the changing nature or structure of the workforce, such that a lot of people aren't working in one enterprise anymore. They're actually working in a number of enterprises across a sector or an industry. What do you think of that proposal, that recognition of that changing nature of the market?
Yeah, so I hadn't actually heard that, but I think it is actually... So there's a couple of things that are interesting about that proposal. The first one is that if you look at the number of people who are covered by different wage bargaining streams. So basically, we think about three. So about 25% of the workforce are covered by the award system or minimum wages in some way. Then another, I think the answer is a third, I can't quite remember the numbers, are covered by enterprise bargaining, and the rest are classified as being covered by independent contracts. The share of people covered by enterprise bargains is actually falling. And it's not a dramatic change, but it seems as if people that are no longer on the enterprise bargains are actually much more likely to be covered by the minimum wage or award wage system. So I think, to the point, I think there's already things happening that suggest that that model isn't working as well for the people involved as it used to. I don't want to overstate how big that change is, but I think, again, one of the things that is really important to recognise is that, if you go back to the 1960s, everything in the labour market was a little bit more black and white and a little bit more modular, and that just isn't the way things are today. And I think it is important to have conversations about whether our institutions and even our definitions are actually keeping up with the reality of how things look. And I think I hinted a couple of times on the way through, there's still a lot of things that we don't understand. And it's not really because we don't understand the questions that we need to ask. It's sometimes we don't have access to the data that would enable us to say something more concrete, because the ABS in particular collects data on the basis of these sorts of definitions that possibly aren't as useful as they could be for answering some of these questions. So I think it's a useful conversation to have. Whether that's the right answer, I don't know.
I'm going on the clock on my far left there, which says that it's 12:30, so it means that we've expelled our time. Alex, thank you so much for that analysis of trends in the labour market. Bit of a who, what, when, where, how, why, and implications work it out type of situation. But because it's there's some guesswork.
Well, I tried to elaborate on some of the implications.
I'm not knocking you at all. The focus being on part-time work was interesting, I thought, because you start the very beginning and identifying your young students, and you made a point about that, about the young people and how much work, part-time work they're doing. The other thing which was great there was the up-to-date statistics. Our textbooks tend to stop at about 2015, 2016, but you would have noticed a lot of those slides there are right up-to-date to 2018. Not too sure how easy it is for us to get access to those.
So the speech and the graphs are available on the website now.
Perfect. There you are.
11:35 they were available, I think.
So all of you economics teachers who want the latest, you've got them. Yep. So there's another big plus. From someone who is a retired person who is working more than 35 hours a week part-time, who considers themselves very much underemployed. I resonate with a lot of those statistics, but I'm not there on the graphs. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in just for a bit of lightheartedness at the end. Thank you so much, Alex. As usual, we have a little thank you gift, and please show your appreciation for Alex.